I've been here for almost 5 years, and we've had a number of military escalations and wars in Gaza. But I talked to neighbors in their 80s who have lived through this incredible violent history of this country, and even they say they've never seen anything like this. They've never felt quite like this.
Steve Hendricks is the Jerusalem bureau chief for The Post. We reached him Monday evening, Israel time, to talk about the violent attacks there by Hamas on Saturday and what's been unfolding since.
The foundations have shifted. Nothing feels the same. People can't quite process what's happening, much less what might happen next. And none of the scenarios are very positive.
And Steve, where are you now? Are you safe?
People in Jerusalem always assumed they were the safest community in Israel because of a city that's beloved by all the combatants, all the religions, you know, fought over, but beloved, and therefore considered to be sort of a little bit immune from attacks and violence. I think I'm safe, but I have to say it doesn't feel as safe as it used to.
On Monday, Israel announced a full siege of the Gaza Strip, saying there would be no food, no electricity, and no fuel. Hamas has attacked Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and other Israeli cities with rockets and taken dozens of hostages. From the newsroom of The Washington Post, this is Post Reports. I'm Rachel Lerman. I'm your guest host today. It's Monday, October 9th. Today, a war in Israel. We talk about how it started, what it means for civilians on both sides, and how it could end. Steve, can you take us back a little bit? What happened this weekend?
Well, it was the end of the long Jewish holidays. It started with Rosh Hashanah and then Yom Kippur, and then this was the second weekend of the Sukkot holiday. There were a lot of family celebrations going on. Things were very shut down here, as they always are on holidays. There was this massive, basically, rave that was happening in the desert area in the south, not too far from the border with Gaza. That's not as unusual as it might sound to people on the outside, but there are communities and normal life all around that area on both sides of the barrier. After many years in which sort of a rhythm of military escalations and then peacetime sort of become the norm, a cycle people knew how to react to and predict. So it was a very relaxed time. Very early on Saturday morning, just really with the sunrise, people on their phones get these alerts when rockets are fired from Gaza. Not too unusual. But there were quite a number that went off very suddenly. I think for many people, that was the first sign that something was happening. The communities around within sort of firing range of Gaza, they did what they do, which is to go to shelters or safe rooms. Again, not that unusual here. Then it took the most bizarre and horrific turn people could imagine. At this dance party that was happening, they began hearing gunshots, and then the field where they were, suddenly gunmen appeared, a great number of them, and a tremendous panic ensued. And people were running, people were getting shot. There's tremendous numbers of videos documenting all this that are sort of circulating endlessly here. Then we began hearing reports from people in shelters, family members getting texts and phone calls. There are gunmen, there are terrorists in our kibbutz, in our street. They're entering houses, they're pulling people out. Unbelievable things that people are still trying to really comprehend. But as the day unfolded, it became clear that this was a major, very well planned, very well executed military attack with strategies and contingencies and multiple modes of entry. They came in out of a breach in the security wall on motorcycles. They went over on paragliders. They went offshore and came up on the beaches. It was a proper invasion from a force that has really never been considered to have those kind of capabilities.
And how did Israeli intelligence miss this?
Well, that's a question that's going to consume this country for years to come. There are no answers at this point. I mean, this is still unfolding. There are still Hamas fighters coming out of Gaza, replacing troops that have been fighting. It's still such an active combat zone in some places. The Israeli military say they are very close to sort of containing the last of those hotspots. But after this comes a response of a scale that we don't know yet, but it's certainly going to be intense. The 1973 Yom Kippur War has always kind of stood up in Israeli history as the biggest failure of intelligence, of readiness, of anticipating, the attack from multiple Arab neighbors.
It is an all-out war. That's how Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Dayan describes an invasion of the Golan Heights and the east bank of the Suez.
This is already being discussed is on a level with that. And as the death count rises and the fate of these dozens and dozens of hostages, many of them civilians, it remains unknown. This could become the most notorious day of unpreparedness in this country's history.
And what has been Israel's response so far?
The military was absolutely, clearly caught off guard. There's a lot of discussion here that they had built this, the estimate is something like $1 billion high-tech security barrier between Gaza and Israel. It includes concrete fences, subterranean barriers, radar, detectors of all kinds. But then they largely left it without enough personnel to monitor it. That seems to be some early analysis. Now, we don't know what the particulars are of deployments, but for whatever reason, there was not a ready military presence at the site of this attack. So for the last many hours now, they've been trying to mount that with the air attacks, with moving tremendous numbers of personnel into the area, going house by house and village by village in the early hours. And now they tell us they think they're close to having the area completely cleared and secure. But we always seem to get another report of more Hamas people coming out, and the fighting just continues.
So can you tell us how civilians are feeling right now inside Israel?
I mean, this is a population that's used to warfare. They're used to rocket attacks. They're used to air raid sirens. They're used to terrorist attacks. I've never felt a mood like this in the country. I don't even quite know how to describe it. It's certainly fear. There's a sort of a gut-churning uncertainty about what's happening now and what's likely to happen. But even about the future of the country, comparing it to 9/11 and the feeling that a lot of Americans had, just not knowing what the future would look like or feel like when our assumptions were so shattered by shocking events.
Right. And it's still so raw. I mean, it just happened, less than 3 days ago.
It's still so raw, and it's just replayed on a loop on social media videos. There's so much documentary evidence of really horrific scenes of people being killed. I just talked to a young woman today whose grandmother, very elderly, lived alone on a kibbutz for most of her life. They lost touch with her after she said someone was coming in the house. And then they saw a video of her being driven in her own golf cart with four Hamas fighters across the barrier into Gaza. And that's the last they know of her. She's very elderly, and they really have very little hope for her safety.
That's terrifying.
So people are watching these things over and over. I mean, I'm sure some families know how to avoid that, but it's in the air and it's just repeating itself.
Can you tell us a little bit about the hostages, about the hostage taking and what Israel is doing to try to get people back?
This is a country that's had a lot of hostage situations through its history. We've had commando raids to rescue hijacked passengers on airliners. We've had a lot of deals to release Hamas prisoners in exchange for a captured Israeli soldier, for example. None of that compares to what's happened here, effectively the mass kidnapping of children and families and elderly people, and then all being held in a very hostile territory. The options are really not good in any case, and the mood here is probably not one for some grand bargain. So there are various estimates, but at least between 100 and 130 captives being held, and their families have a very real prospect of watching a massive military operation unfold that probably will not go well for anyone in Gaza, captive or resident.
So Netanyahu has vowed to destroy Hamas, but what does that mean for the people in Gaza? Is there a way for civilians to leave?
You know, I'm afraid the options to leave Gaza are incredibly limited. I know plenty of people want to. I know because our very close, longtime Washington Post colleague, Hazem.
Take your time. There's no hurry.
Hazem Belusha is trying to get out with his wife and two young sons. We've been working to find a way. There aren't many. Some people are getting out through the crossing with Egypt, but even that is restricted. There are lists, and there are great barriers to that we and he and thousands of other people have yet to overcome. Many, many people are basically trapped there.
That's very scary.
Yeah.
Steve, can you take us back a little bit? This is a really big question, and I know there's a lot of history here about land and religion, but can you remind us why Hamas and Israel are fighting now?
Well, Hamas is recognized as a terrorist group by Israel, the United States, the European Union. It came to power when it, surprisingly, more than 15 years ago, won an election. And after that, Israel had to make a decision about, and the rest of the world, how to relate to this terrorist organization that was suddenly effectively the government of this enclave of 2 million people. And so it's been messy, it's been complicated, there's been exchanges and military fighting across the border for all of that period, including some quite major and deadly full-out wars. There's a mix of people who try to influence Hamas and steer it, including the Qataris and the Egyptians. It's a rival of the other major Palestinian party, Fatah, which is dominant in the West Bank and controls the Palestinian Authority, which is the governing body of the West Bank. And it's always been a bit of a back and forth about exactly how militant and how terroristic is this group. Are they becoming more moderated as they have had the responsibilities of governing? It's a very difficult place, Gaza. I was just there a few weeks ago. There's not reliable fresh water. There's not reliable electricity. Part of that is the effect of a very tight economic embargo that Israel maintains. Part of it is certainly Hamas mismanagement, misgovernment, corruption, and really their priority being, you know, a resistance to the Israeli occupation. And what I think we've just seen is throwing away all the other aspirations they may have had as an entity to govern or to play a positive role, and full-on commitment to the armed resistance and an attack on Israel.
And is it fair to say that tensions between Israel and Hamas have been escalating recently?
Yeah, they definitely cycle. My colleague Hazem and I just did a story last month about how it seemed to be ticking up again. It's been relatively calm for several months, even as the West Bank has seen almost nightly military clashes in various cities and camps. Gaza had actually kind of settled down for the summer. And a lot of workers who had permits to cross the border into Israel did that, up to more than 16,000 of them. But then just in the last few weeks, the cycle seemed to turn and maybe turn faster than we recognized. There was an incident in which Israel discovered some explosive materials being smuggled out in a shipment of blue jeans. Hamas came out and declared that a couple of the perpetrators of some killings of civilians in the West Bank were their operatives. Israel froze that number of permitted workers. So this sort of delicate attempt on both sides to achieve what they call an economic peace with the benefits of integration flowing back to the population kind of went off the rails. That's not the first time that's happened, and people, I think, had a lot of hopes that it would get righted again. There were analysts on both sides, including people I talked to in Gaza, who really said neither side wanted a major escalation at this point. It just didn't serve their interest. And they and we were just as wrong as everybody else about what they were planning.
After the break, we'll talk about domestic politics in Israel and the global response to Hamas's attack. We'll be right back.
In-laws, love them or hate them, you're pretty much stuck with them. And when you're a ruler in the Middle Ages, that can be a serious problem. It might even land you dead. I'm Dan Jones, and on season 4 of This Is History, I'm telling the story of England's weirdest king, Henry III. He's in way over his head, and he's surrounded by bloodthirsty relatives with their eyes on his throne. To listen, search This Is History and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, it's me, Jesse Tyler Ferguson, that redheaded actor from Modern Family. I have a podcast. It's combining a couple of my favorite things, talking and food. Please join me as I dine with the biggest names in entertainment. People like Julie Bowen, Kristen Bell, Fred Armisen, and so many more. It's called Dinners on Me, and you're invited. Am I saying a chocolate souffle is going to get me to reveal all of my secrets? Yeah, I am. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Steve, this conflict comes at a time when there's already a lot of political upheaval within Israel. Last time you were on the show, it was to talk about the political crisis over a move from Netanyahu's government to weaken the judiciary, which a lot of people in Israel saw as anti-democratic. Can you remind us of that context?
That's a great example of how the last 2 days have really just shifted the plates here entirely. Mm-hmm. This year has marked the most intense domestic political upheaval in Israel's history. Massive protest every week in reaction to this government's plan to restructure the judicial system here, basically limiting the power of the prosecutors in the Supreme Court, limiting the power of the Supreme Court to overturn certain government rules that it deemed unreasonable or unconstitutional. Even though Israel doesn't have a written constitution, those concepts are the same as in the United States. As part of those protests, for the first time ever, really, at large scale, members of the military took part protesting the government. Thousands of reservists, who are really a backbone of the Israeli military, said they would not turn out for training in the course of this, and, you know, as their leverage point to stop this legislation. So there were a lot of concerns. A lot of security officials were saying publicly that it was a dangerous moment for readiness, that Israel wasn't prepared, as it tries always to be. You know, there were a lot of questions about what would happen if in a major emergency. So the emergency came and the response from the protesters and those reservists who had joined them was immediately to put on uniforms for the reservists, to cancel the protests for the demonstrators. I would say, with no exceptions that I can see, you know, the country is responding here with one voice. And all of that concern, all of that controversy, it'll come back in some form right now, but it has just been wiped away from the country's consciousness.
Wow, so that's a pretty dramatic shift very quickly.
Overnight, in hours, that happened.
Mm-hmm. How has the international community responded so far to this conflict? What kind of response are we seeing from outside Israel?
Well, you know, the waves of shock just keep radiating outward, and you know, endless expressions of support. Some countries are trying to organize evacuations of their citizens. It's not that, for example, the United States has called for Americans to leave, as the State Department will do in some very dangerous circumstances. But there are very few flights coming in and out. So they're trying to find avenues for people who want to leave. And I know that's true for many embassies. But more materially, I mean, we see that Washington is deploying warships to the area. The president has pledged enormous strategic, you know, immediate military support for whatever Israel needs. It's raised questions about whether we can be supporting the ammunition needs of both Ukraine and now this conflict. Mm. But it is a testament to, I think, how seriously the world is treating the moment.
So how does this end? In the past, in these situations, there's been a third-party country that would broker peace. Is that possible here? Who might volunteer to do that?
Well, I mean, I guess we want anything to be possible, but there's no sight of anything like that so far. This is still happening. This is still unfolding, and it feels like only the first phase of it is unfolding, and then there's going to be a very frightening next phase, which will probably mean very intense fighting in Gaza, which has already begun with very heavy airstrikes around the enclave. You know, we know from experience that the moments for diplomacy to step in and have effect are usually not in the heat of the early days. So I think what happens next is really one of the questions that has Israelis very disoriented, and Palestinians too. I've talked to Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza, and they're, you know, they're terrified of how this might unfold. I have yet to talk to anybody who offers any confidence of anything soon or positive.
Steve, thank you so much for doing this. Stay safe. We're thinking of you.
All right. Thanks, you guys.
Steve Hendricks covers Israel for The Post. That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. Today's show was produced by Emma Talkoff with help from Ariel Plotnick. It was mixed by Sean Carter and edited by Maggie Penman. If you want to show your support for the show, please subscribe to The Washington Post. It's a great way to help us do this work. Go to washingtonpost.com/subscribe. I'm Rachel Lerman. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.